You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. About 300 Afghans chanted anti-American and anti-British slogans in Kabul today in the first such protest since U.S.-led forces toppled the fundamentalist Taliban in late 2001. The protesters, who included government employees and university students, complained of growing insecurity, slow post-war reconstruction, and delay in payment of state salaries by Hamid Karzai, the U.S.-backed government. As the Bush administration worked to pacify and restructure post-war Iraq, continuing violence and power struggles between various factions are creating an unstable and dangerous situation. In the latest in a series of confrontations between the U.S. military and Iraqi civilians opposed to American occupation, U.S. troops shot and killed 15 civilians and wounded 75 demonstrators who were protesting the soldiers' presence in the town of Fallujah. Despite the U.S. Central Command's effort to prevent Iraqis from celebrating the 66th birthday of ousted leader Saddam Hussein, a number of commemorations did take place, especially around the former leader's hometown of Tikrit. Retired Lieutenant General Jay Garner, the man appointed by the Bush administration to rule post-war Iraq, organized an April 28th closed-door meeting of hand-picked Iraqi citizens and exiles to begin the formation of a U.S.-backed transitional government. But this heavily guarded assembly drew the ire of several thousand Shiite protesters who claimed that the meeting did not represent the interests of the Shiite religion, practiced by 60% of Iraq's population. Concerned about the growing political strength of Shiite clerics in Iraq, the White House warned the government of neighboring Iran, also a majority Shiite nation, not to interfere in Iraq's internal affairs. News that the Bush administration was considering the selection of former CIA Director James Woolsey as an advisor to any new U.S.-appointed Iraqi Minister of Information, and the inclusion of the former chief executive of Shell Oil Company of an American-created council to oversee Iraq's oil industry, has done little to quell suspicion of America's motives in the country. Scott Harris, co-producer of the syndicated radio program Between the Lines, recently spoke with Mansour Farhang, professor of political science at Bennington College in Vermont and a native of Iran. Farhang assesses the religious and political opposition facing the Bush administration as it attempts to install a new government in Baghdad.
Iraq was like a prison for 30 years. It was really an incredibly vicious machinery of repression. And people who have gotten rid of this thing, we don't really know exactly about their political tendencies, their preferences, their reflections, what kind of an impact this experience has had on them. So in the short run, the most radical and the most vocal, the most passionate elements could appear to have dominated this scene. But I doubt very much if they really represent the sentiments and preferences of the Iraqi people. So we have to wait and see. But with respect to exiles, exiles do not have a popular base in Iraq. But if there is a consensus, if there is a collective attempt to move toward an inclusive pluralistic system, definitely the exiles could be very important, not so much as political leaders, but as managers, as technocrats.
But is the United States and the Bush administration making a mistake by putting these exiles at the head of the line, so to speak, for control and positions of importance in this interim government that they're now putting together?
Absolutely. If the United States does this, it means this the claim of wanting to promote democracy is a complete deception, that it's impossible to take Mr. Chalabi or others like him, however they might be competent technocrats or businessmen and all that, but they will have no relationship with the Iraqi people. And it would be impossible to create a legitimate political order by appointing these people who have been associated close to the CIA, the State Department, which means this strategy means everything the Bush administration is saying about democracy is a complete deception. There is no sincerity in making an effort. But the first step toward really identifying a movement toward democracy is the extent to which people and their representatives are involved in the political process, and that remains to be seen yet.
What can you tell us about the various power movements within the Shia clerics that are now involved in the struggle for power, and what, if any, are their connections with Iran's government, as the Bush administration charges and warns against their interference in the affairs of post-war Iraq?
Ayatollah Hakim and his brother, they have lived in Iran since 1980. They're very close to the Iranian government. And they also have an armed force of about 10,000 armed men, militias trained and equipped by the Iranian Revolutionary Guards. They're still in Iran. And the Hakim definitely is interested in taking these forces to Iraq. He even suggested to the American commander that they wanted to help them to take over Basra, and the United States rejected their help. This is one group. Now, exactly how influential the Iranians are with respect to duplicating the project of the Iranian revolution remains to be seen. But there are many other clerics who do not want an Islamic Republic, who think religion should play a role, but not in terms of creating a theocracy. There are conservative elements such as Ayatollah Sistani, who is the most senior and perhaps has the largest following in Iraq. He even doesn't want the clerics to get involved in politics. There are other some clerical elements who are very close to the United States. Ayatollah Khoui, the man who was assassinated in Iraq a couple of weeks ago, he was very close to the CIA, but he represents a group of people based in London. The most radical elements are the ones who say we want to establish an Islamic Republic of Iraq. And Iran is in a very difficult and tenuous position. Helping this particular wing of the Shi'i movement is very dangerous because the United States could, you know, retaliate. On the other hand, it is, you know, it's a kind of an ideological crisis for them if they stand on the sideline and watch them. But my guess is that they calculate their political interests, and after what has happened to Iraq, and after the pressure on Iran with respect to the nuclear issue, Iranians will do nothing. They might engage in propaganda, but will do nothing in terms of material assistance or arms shipments across the border to help anybody, because helping any one group in Iraq means instigating civil war in Iraq. It's, in my opinion, it's unthinkable for Iraq to have a regime like the one in Iran. It's impossible for any one group in Iraq to dominate the entire country. That's why I am somewhat optimistic that Iraqis, if they are genuinely interested in creating order and stability in their society, movement toward democracy becomes a necessity. This is the only way they can live together. Otherwise, it will be a bloody and unending conflict.
Well, what do you make of the United States' rejection of any United Nations involvement in overseeing the organization of an interim government? It seems that all over the Middle East, many people in governments are suspect of the motives of the United States' invasion of Iraq, and the fact that the UN is not being allowed in as some kind of neutral referee to put together such an interim government. Does that not fuel these suspicions?
Definitely, definitely. It's a very negative. That makes me very skeptical about the American claim of promoting, you know, democracy, because if the United States wants to impose a client state, a new form of dictatorship, perhaps not as cruel as Saddam Hussein, but dictatorship in the sense that there is no open political competition and participation in the country, that's why they don't want the UN. But if the United States is interested in actually promoting democracy, then the UN can play a fantastic role of legitimizing the process. The Iraqis who work with the UN, if the UN was involved in assisting the process of conciliation, consensus building, and constitution building, and so forth, the Iraqis associating with the UN would have gained legitimacy. That's why I feel very skeptical that the United States is really not interested in democracy, and imposition means doing it alone, and they don't need any international observer.
Mansour Farhang, professor of political science at Bennington College in Vermont and a native of Iran. He was speaking with Scott Harris, the co-producer of the syndicated radio program Between the Lines. With the occupation of Iraq well underway and the U.S. military still poised to fight two or three wars at once on various fronts, the need for soldiers is greater than ever before. In the absence of a draft, the armed forces find themselves struggling to retain seasoned personnel and recruiting men and women to replace them. So they're turning to more creative means. In one instance, a few years ago, Army recruiters offered $6,000 to anyone who would enlist within 7 days. On another occasion, the Navy was 22,000 sailors short of a needed force, a dilemma which was only resolved after it was forced to admit more recruits without high school diplomas. Peace Watch spoke earlier this week with John Judge, who works with the Washington Peace Center and is an expert on military recruiting in high schools and on the filing of conscientious objector status.
Well, what I refer to as a poverty draft or economic conscription is what the system likes to call a volunteer military. It really began and was consciously planned as an alternative to a selective service draft and conscription system that had broken down by the end of the Vietnam War, to the point that they had to put out 4 induction orders to get one person to report. In its place, they began to use people's limited economic opportunities and a massive advertising campaign aimed at youth in order to get people into the military that way instead. And it actually works more effectively than the old draft system did. It brings in between 400,000 and 450,000 people a year into the military, but it also loses 75% of them before they finish their first term of enlistment.
Why is that?
Well, it's a variety of reasons, but a lot of times they bring in unqualified recruits, or they have problems adjusting to military life. They have family hardships or medical problems that the military causes them, or fail to detect on the way in. A number of them just wash out, sometimes even in the first 6 months, because of disciplinary or other problems. And the military has a grading system. At the end of your military term, you're given a grade of discharge. And if you don't get a fully honorable discharge, you lose veteran benefits. And if you had paid into the GI education bill, you lose that money as well as the matching funds. And you lose VA services for health care. And you're also marked for life then, for every employer you want to go to. Was showing what your grade of military discharge was, and it creates a system of 60 to 100% employer discrimination against those without a fully honorable discharge.
So I want to get a good, clear picture of basically how these enlistees are being graded, given the fact that you've said that this is a record that's going to follow them throughout life. Is it just that you went in and you had a bad attitude, or is it more than that?
Well, I wouldn't blame it on the enlistee. I think they're entering the least democratic and the most venal, racist, and sexist, and classist institution within the society, and they shouldn't be expected to adjust to it. Even the tests that are administered, the Armed Services Vocational Aptitude Battery, that tracks what kind of work you'll get, is racially and sexually biased, and that's been determined by people who look at tests educationally. But it's a common aptitude test that's even given in the high schools because it's free to the schools, not to the taxpayer. The military, in their own studies in the 1970s, admitted that the primary reasons for bad discharge were racism on the part of the command or lack of education on the part of the enlistee. I think if it had been any corporation spending what the military does to recruit and train people, and they were losing them at that rate and having that level of absenteeism and infractions, that somebody in the personnel department would come down and find out what's going on, or the corporation would have gone broke long ago.
So the flip side of that is, who are the people that are able to make it through and are score high in that environment, and what can we conclude from that?
It's a training ground. I mean, I think it's a way to ensure an unemployable section of the population, about 200 a day that dump out with bad paper, a lot of them people of color. But if you are willing to go along with the authoritarian mode, if you're willing to live in a situation where you're under 24-hour control, where you can't have a union, you can't talk back to the boss or petition or assemble or demonstrate, where you can't assert your rights in any effective way, you're willing to follow every order that you're given without a question, that's, if you mesh into that, that's probably good training for the corporate world later, but you also don't learn any usable skill. And 85% of the veterans coming out of the military right now complain that they haven't learned anything they can use in civilian life.
Is the corporate world really that bad?
Well, I'm sure that most corporations would like people to learn those lessons.
Never talk back to the boss.
Yes.
Okay. But now,
these are crimes in the military. You know, walking off the job, talking back to the boss, trying to petition on your own behalf.
Mm-hmm. And so, according to an article written in the Washington Informer in January 2003, activists allege that D.C. public schools are being turned into military zones. Can you tell us about the junior military recruitment program established in the thousands of U.S. public high schools? Is the junior ROTC really a sound educational program, in your opinion?
Not at all, and I don't think there have ever been any empirical studies to show that it improves grade level or even retention in the school. People drop out of our junior ROTC faster than they drop out of the high school. In fact, in D.C., they probably only meet their federal minimal quotas to get the federal end of the funding by forcing in three of the schools that we know of the entire freshman class to take junior ROTC, but 95% are gone by the senior year from the program. And it's a program that's been expanded. They're in, I believe it's 3,000 high schools nationwide, and that was a bump up of about double from where they were after the riots in Los Angeles when Colin Powell decided that this would be the way to provide discipline for black youth and poor youth in the schools, and so they began to expand the program. But the reality, of course, is that it's a recruiting program. They deny it up and down, but we know that anybody that takes any level of JRTC is much more likely to enlist. And the curriculum includes military career options and paths and inculcates military values and world attitude to these young people. So although they get no particular benefit out of it, it's misnamed to call it a reserve officer training corps because only about 2 to 5% of the people become officers anyway by their own admission. They become enlisted recruits at the bottom of the pile. And they especially have focused putting these units into the schools of color and schools of poverty. So and they were able for many years to keep the recruiters out.
Well, how did that change?
It changed because this law requires if they take any federal funding, they have to let them in. And it overrides, the local law. I don't know that it's been tested in court, but, basically they're saying, okay, if you won't let us in, we're going to pull your federal funds. However, we would like to turn that provision of the law as worded on its head and make it do what it says, which is that recruiters have the same access as everybody else, not unequal access, and that recruiters would only come in one day a year as we do or 2 days a year on the career day event.
It also sounds like the federal courts have to decide which law is going to have precedent. If you have one law saying you have to allow them in and you have one law that's saying we can't allow any employers in who discriminate.
Well, I think it would make an interesting case.
So a young man or woman that wants to be presented with some options or some choices should contact one of these groups, Vets for Peace or the Central Committee
for Conscientious Objectors.
For Conscientious Objectors.
Objector.org on the Internet, www.objector.org is one place to start, or WRL.org or VFP for Vets for Peace.org. Mm-hmm. So you can start there and start to get some basic information. The American Friends Service Committee nationally has a page on youth and militarism that has a lot of good statistical information on recruitment and the different methods.
And you can put them on a path to economic and social development that does not lead to the front lines of Baghdad.
Yeah, one would hope so. Some economic development is going to lead some people to the front lines of Baghdad looking for the profits from the oil and the resources that they've now grabbed, I'm sure. The personnel aspect of the military is one that many anti-military activists and organizations don't deal with. They talk about weapon systems, costs, budget, foreign policy, all of that is important, but it also all involves people. And as somebody who from the 1960s on has worked with GIs and veterans, as a counselor and supporter, and then done this work with young people that are facing the recruitment choices, I think that putting our attention on this will bear fruit in the long run in ways that some other anti-war work may not. And I encourage people to try to take a look at this question from the roots of where they go in the community and how they're militarizing the whole society from the point that they do the enlistment to the point that the returning veterans aren't readjusted in terms of their violence and other aspects. And I think it cuts across many, many other related issues that people have in their movements for social justice in ways that can be enlightening to all of us. And I think we need to make this military our military again and not that it be something that the Pentagon owns and controls. It's the last Western nation in the world with an internal military judicial system. It's the worst of the social institutions. Even if you could get a draft to bring in some sort of demographically equal group to the gate of the U.S. military, which you can't, but even if you could, you'd be pushing them into the worst sort of racist and sexist and classist structure.
So clearly a nation needs to have a military. So do you support having a mandatory draft?
No, I don't. I think that the solution has to do with taking control of the military, its size and its purpose, that it stopped being an imperial military, and then it wouldn't need to be so large. It wouldn't need to have these questions, and that then you treat people right. You give them what you promise them when they come in. You treat them right when they come out of the situation. The problem with conscription is it makes it even more likely that wars will go on, and it never can be fair. There's not a single son of a congressperson that went drafted into the war in Vietnam. I think there were two congresspeople that currently had somebody serving in the time of this war. And so the very rich will, even if all you leave in are medical, extreme hardship, and conscientious objection deferments, which is just common sense, decency, and the Constitution, the people who can articulate those, who can document those, and who can be listened to or will be listened to when they present them are still going to cut across those lines. I think the problem is we've got a military that's out of control, that has a completely different purpose than it should, and until you address that internal problem, trying to tinker with what forces people to go into the military isn't going to improve it. I don't support either the poverty draft or the conscription. What I support is a different kind of military.
Mm. Well, playing the devil's advocate, a different type of military, is that going to be one that would be effective on the battlefield?
Sure. I don't see any reason it couldn't be. I mean, for instance, it's a crime in the military here to attempt to organize a union. But in all the other Western nations and other industrialized nations that have any size of military, they're unionized. I mean, just as an example, I think that we've got this idea that this is the only model of a military that can possibly operate, and it's just not. It depends on what you want the military to do. If you want it to defend the United States rather than stick its nose in the business of all the rest of the countries of the world, then it can do that much more efficiently and cheaply than it does now and without creating these problems for people here and abroad.
John Judge is with the Washington Peace Center. With the war on Iraq winding down, a list of countries including Syria, Iran, and North Korea are now wondering whether they might be the next target of what they perceive as U.S. military belligerence. Add to that list now, Cuba. Cuba came under harsh criticism last month, even from some of its regular supporters on the left. They criticized the nation's execution of three men accused of terrorism in the unsuccessful hijacking of a ferry full of passengers. The men were trying to seek asylum in the U.S. Also a source of criticism was Cuba's recent imprisonment of 75 political dissidents, including many authors and independent journalists, for terms of up to 28 years. Cuban leader Fidel Castro accused them of working with the U.S. to undermine Cuba's government, a charge the dissidents and the U.S. State Department have denied. Speaking at a May Day rally in Havana, Castro deflected criticism of his recent actions and continued accusing the U.S. of fomenting unrest on the island. He began by talking about a speech President Bush delivered last June at West Point Military Academy's 200th anniversary.
At the West Point speech, he doesn't mention once the United Nations organization, nor is there a phrase about every people's right to safety and peace, or about the need for a world ruled by principles and norms. I don't think that a fascist regime can be established in the United States. Serious mistakes have been made and injustices committed in the framework of its political system. Many of them still persist. But the American people still have a number of institutions and traditions, as well as educational, cultural, and ethical values that would hardly allow that to happen. The risk exists in the international arena, though. The power and prerogatives of that country's president are so extensive and the economic, technological, and military power network in that nation is so pervasive that due to circumstances that fully escape the will of the American people, the world is coming under the rule of Nazi concepts and methods. The miserable insects that live in 60 or more countries of the world chosen by him and his closest assistants, and in the case of Cuba, by his Miami friends, are completely irrelevant. They are the dark corners of the world that may become the targets of their unannounced and preemptive attacks. Not only Cuba is one of those countries, but Cuba has also been included among those that sponsor terrorism. I mentioned the idea of the world tyranny for the first time exactly 1 year, 3 months, and 19 days before the attack on Iraq. In the days prior to the beginning of the war, President Bush repeated once again that the United States will use, if necessary, any means within its arsenal. In other words, nuclear weapons, chemical weapons, and biological weapons. Today, the so-called dissidents, actually mercenaries on the payroll of the Hitler-like government of Bush, are not only betraying their homeland, but all of humanity as well. In the face of the sinister plans against our country on the part of that neo-fascist extreme right and its allies in the Miami terrorist mob that ensured its victory through electoral fraud, I wonder how many of those individuals with supposedly leftist and humanistic stances who have attacked our people over the legal measures we were forced to adopt as a legitimate defense against the aggressive plans of the superpower located just a few miles off our coasts and with a military base on our own territory have been able to read these words. We wonder how many have recognized, denounced, and condemned the policy announced in the speeches that by Mr. Bush that I have quoted, which reveal a sinister Nazi-fascist international policy on the part of the leader of the country with the most powerful military force ever imagined, whose weapons could destroy the defenseless humanity 10 times over. The entire world has been mobilized by the terrifying images of cities destroyed and burned by the brutal bombing, images of maimed children, and the shattered corpses of innocent people. We wouldn't want those who have, in our opinion, attacked Cuba unjustly due to misinformation or a lack of careful and profound analysis, to have to suffer the infinite sorrow they will feel if one day our cities are destroyed and our children and mothers, women and men, young and old, are torn apart by the bombs of Nazi fascism, and then they realize that their statements were shamelessly manipulated by the aggressors to justify a military attack on Cuba.
Cuban President Fidel Castro speaking through a translator at a May 1st rally in Havana. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is Granger Helvey. Our associate producer is Angelique Shofar. We had production assistance from Jim Bennett and Otto Hammett of KPFA, Eddie Becker, Richard Wright, and Benta Berkland. We'd like to thank all of our listeners for their generous financial support over the past several weeks in response to our urgent appeal. Thanks to your support, Peace Watch will continue to be broadcast. If you'd like to continue to support Peace Watch, you you can make a pledge through our secure online website at pacifica.org, or you can send your donations to Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.